hostile territory for people on the left these days. So my patrimony will never become my own.
Okay, thanks very much, Tony, for coming on the podcast. I'm sure we will have you on again.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you again. Good luck.
Thanks so much, Tony. And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakout, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, support the Electronic Intifada by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 11 a.m. Next up, we have Art Talk Bus Stop, a show produced by students and educators from Reynolds High School.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of 15X, Friday, February 28th, from 5 to 10 p.m. at the Social Justice Action Center in Portland. 15X is a local hip-hop show that features a wide variety of local hip-hop and R&B artists from Portland. Again, that's 15X on Friday, February 28th, from 5 to 10 p.m. at the Social Justice Action Center, 400 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, we're Pacific Underground on KBOO Community Radio. Our show is on hiatus until May, and until then, we are looking for new members to join the collective. Pacific Underground is the only show by and for Asians and Pacific Islanders in the Pacific Northwest. There's no experience necessary to join, just an enthusiasm for API content and stories through the medium of community radio. If you are Asian or Pacific Islander and are interested in joining, please contact us at pacificunderground@kboo.org, all one word. Or message us on Instagram at @PACUnderground.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven natural foods cooperative open daily from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and a weekly farmer's market every Wednesday, year-round. Located at Southeast Tibbetts Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years, online at peoples.coop.
Welcome to the Art Talk Bus Stop. I am Emily Brown, and our guest here is Kelly Rohr, and then we also have Erica here to help us produce. So Kelly, what do you do as like your job, like work?
I run my own company as a building construction contractor. I do tile and finish carpentry primarily. And then as a non-paid job, I am one of a group of collective members who run a nonprofit, all volunteer run nonprofit called S1, which is a nonprofit music and education space in Portland.
So can you talk more about the S1?
Yeah, I have been working with S1 for about 4+ years. S1 as a nonprofit is 5 years old. We focus on experimental sound and music. We have a synth library that has all donated equipment, a lot of Eurorack analog synthesizers, keyboard synthesizers, other devices, pedals. We've started a collection of video synth and glitch video equipment, which is really exciting. One of our main missions actually is to provide access and space and community for marginalized folks from the LGBTQ community to BIPOC, and also supporting women, trans, and non-binary folks to feel supported and comfortable in learning how to use lots of audio equipment and music gear. So we do workshops, classes. We're also a venue, so we do performances. Sometimes we do visual art exhibitions, a whole host of things.
Do you have like live performers like do your stuff like with the music, or is it like a teaching thing?
All of the above. So we have some of our members will teach workshops on how to use specific gear or how to use Eurorack or the foundations of synthesis. We have a lot of DIY classes, so learning how to actually build electronics, which is one of the ways I got started. Mm-hmm. And then we also do live performances for musicians and other types of performers.
Mm. Okay, do you want to talk about your tile work that you make money off of?
I mean, I think I'm like trying to think of what is would be most interesting and helpful for y'all to know about my trajectory. In terms of the building work, it's been a really important part of my income generating options, because it allows me a lot of flexibility and freedom to do the work that I really care about, which is making my own art and also supporting the communities that I care about in music and other types of art. I'm able to craft my space and time in a much more fluid way that's in my control, so that I can make space and time for volunteering and running S1. Hmm. But that's also been kind of the way that I've made my living the whole time. So like out of high school into college, figuring out, you know, how can I craft my life in a way that I can make enough money to meet my basic needs, but also not be so consumed with making money that I don't have any time to do the things that I really care about. So that was a big thing leaving college, was figuring out how to be in the arts without like a official arts degree. I think at one point I had 5 jobs.
Wow.
I was working in a restaurant, I was working as a gallery assistant, and I was doing some house painting, which was my own gig I started, painting my mom's friends' houses, being a volunteer at a nonprofit art center. And so I was kind of crafting everything, mm-hmm. all these random jobs, so that I had my own time to work and volunteer for this art installation nonprofit. Mm. So it's not a direct answer to your question, but I can talk more about my building work if that's useful.
So you said tile work, like, mm-hmm. do you make tiles or like?
I don't make the tiles. It's mostly installation. Mm, so
yeah,
people end up doing a lot of kitchens and bathrooms. That's usually where people want tile. Most of it's not super creative work. It's usually creative problem solving that's required. But sometimes I get a really fun creative project where I get to be more involved in doing something more interesting with the tile, like picking a really beautiful type of tile that's not that's a non-standard shape, or helping someone design their look that they want.
But yeah.
Usually it's pretty standard stuff.
Are you like a company like owner? Like, do you own your company? Mm-hmm. So you have people work for you?
Yeah. So I spent about 2 years working with my brother and a friend of mine, increasing my skills and, you know, not being the lead, but learning a lot. And then in January, I decided I wanted to start my own company. So I took all the tests and got my license and insurance and started my own company. And it's been a year that's been quite successful. I've really only needed to have one assistant that comes on here or there. She's amazing, yeah. And I'm very thankful that she's been able to work with me. It's kind of hard to find another person who has the skills, who is a good worker, and who is also available randomly and doesn't need consistent work. It's kind of boom or bust. You can get a lot of projects, and then you might have a month and a half or more where there aren't any projects. So you need someone who kind of has their own, also other things going on.
Was it difficult to like start up your company?
It wasn't. I mean, it was difficult in the sense of believing that that was something that I could do, and getting myself to finally read the entire contracting book, which is incredibly boring.
Yeah.
And is basically they just want to know that you know where to find the specific laws and codes, and it's an open book test. I was like really trying to be really good about it and like read the whole thing, mm-hmm. but I really just needed to just schedule the exam, mm-hmm. and then show up and do it, because it really wasn't that hard in the end. In believing in my own capacity to run my own business, that felt like a really big step. That was probably the hardest piece.
Yeah.
But it was, all of my jobs have been referrals or friends that I know. So far I haven't had to do any major marketing or advertising, and the jobs have just continued to come in. And so I've been really grateful.
Are you like based in Portland, or do you go like spread out a little bit, or just like?
I prefer that I don't have to commute more than 25 minutes. If I'm 30, 45, I'm less likely to take that job. Mm. Yeah. Unless they're willing to pay a trip fee or something.
Yeah. What do you love most about your job or like company?
The freedom to decide how much work I have.
Mm.
Yeah, I am not interested in being a major stressed out hustling contractor who is exhausted and tired and stressed out all the time and stacking projects one after another just to like go get the money.
Yeah.
So I've really appreciate that I can sort of have a really nice life work balance. That's been really important for me.
I'd like to ask, what is your like daily routine?
Well, I'd say my daily routine is that I don't really have one beyond what maybe my morning looks like. And then the rest of the day is dependent on if I have, if I'm working on a project gig, or if I'm, having to spend a day doing a bunch of admin work, or if I'm doing a lot for S1, you know, a work day for building work is getting up early, coffee, breakfast, maybe some exercising.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know that I really have a routine. I do feel like, if you're interested, my sort of trajectory of what I did in high school and how I arrived at being able to run a nonprofit and be involved in the arts would probably be cool to share with y'all.
Yeah, go ahead.
I did mostly theater and photography in high school. I also was always a dancer. I grew up dancing, and that was a really important part of my life. But I did not know in high school that you could get a degree in dance or that you could get paid to be a dancer. I did not know really that that there were that many options in the arts. And being someone who also loves science, I kind of had convinced myself that that was the path I was going to focus on. Despite that I basically lived and breathed art forever. you know, actually doing theater set building was the first time I realized that I loved building. That was actually where I started to gain a lot of my construction skills, was through set design and building in high school. And then in college, I continued to study photography and dance on the side. But kind of realized that I was not super into doing theater tech. I had an opportunity to do that at a community college that I went to first, and I sort of realized that I maybe wanted to try a different trajectory and continue to focus on photography. And when I graduated from Evergreen State College up in Olympia, Washington, I was really eager to be involved in the arts. I was looking for something different, and I discovered a little nonprofit art center called the Portland Art Center that was focused on installation art. And I kind of decided that that was what I wanted to do, and I would figure out what jobs I would need to have in order to do that almost all the time. And in that environment, we were building walls and taking walls down and building structures for artists. And so I was working with artists who had a lot of different skill sets. And so through that job, I was like acquiring a lot more skills. I was also learning about nonprofit management and arts management. And I basically stayed in arts management for the next 5 years, moving from nonprofit to professional for-profit galleries, doing a lot of preparator work, so helping artists design their exhibition and install it. I worked with PNCA, the art school in town, and also OCAC, which is no longer there, with their student exhibitions, coordinating and curating. Just being around artists was like an incredible way for me to learn about my own art practice. And it really felt like that was my master's. Like at one point I thought getting a master's in arts was something I was like really wanted to do and was really important. But I kind of quickly realized that I was getting a much better education by being surrounded by and working with artists all the time. And I got to see their trajectory from their idea to working through how to install it and, you know, final exhibition of their work, and learning the pitfalls and the things that they could have done better and how I might do it differently. So that was my master's. And it was a really important time. And I think the thing that's important to remember, at least I thought it was really important, is like every industry or art practice that I was interested in, there are ways to be engaged and to volunteer and to be an artist assistant or work with artists. And that is one of the best ways to learn more about the thing that you're trying to do. And it's often really great and a great way to be involved in community and get to know more artists if you find places to volunteer, because it can be entry points to like get into shows for free because you're running the door, or, you know, helping clean up afterwards or helping set up. That can be a really great way to build community in an area of interest. And that can sometimes lead to paid work. But often it's more about finding ways to support whatever it is that you're most excited about.
Yeah, it's very interesting. How did you start like SI? You said someone passed it down to you.
S1,
sorry.
That's okay. So S1 was run primarily by two founders, Felicia and Alex, and then a third person, Alyssa DeRubis, who's helped co-found the Synth Library. And it was primarily run by them, and volunteers would help. And they actually started a series called the Women's Beat League about 3.5 years ago. There was a whole series of workshops focused only for female, feminine, non-binary folks to learn everything from record DJing, CD DJing, intro to synthesis, a whole series of workshops. And I thought that was really, really important. And it was really amazing that like every class had 20 plus people in it. And I thought what they were doing was really important. So I just kind of stayed really close. It was hard to volunteer sometimes, but I just kept showing up, being part of the community, participating, going to shows. About a year before the Felicia and Alex decided to step down, to pursue other opportunities, I got the opportunity to be a little bit closer and start being more like a staff person, even though everyone is a volunteer. No one gets paid to do anything at S1 right now. And so I was able to come in and use my many years of art management experience to support something that I really cared about, that was supporting a really important community for me. And then when they stepped down, it was really like, is anyone around who wants to keep this going? And that was just the question, like, was there enough of us to come forward to take it over, or was it going to be shut down? And thankfully and amazingly, there was a about a group of nine of us, 9 to 12, depending on the day or the month, who were really focused on making sure that it survived and had a new future. So I just stepped forward and started being a staff member.
I have a question. Can I jump in?
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you want to talk a little bit about the relationship between what you do at S1 and your work as a musician.
Mm. Thanks. Yeah, the programming that they were doing was essential for me as a musician and the development of my work as a musician. I started in photography, transferred those skill sets into doing video work and video installations. And then at that time I brought together dance work and video work. And in doing video work, I also started working with sound, and then sound became more important to me. And music has always been incredibly important to me as a dancer. And I kind of got to a place where I was like, I really want to be able to make my own sound and music for my video. And I would love to be able to craft the music that I want to hear. Like, I wasn't really hearing like real specific types of sounds or music that I was interested in making. And so I really started to shift my interest from video then more into music making. But it took a solid 3 years for me to be where I am right now in terms of having equipment and being a producer and making music and playing live. I've been grateful that I've had S1 and access to the equipment to learn what kind of equipment I wanted to work with, what type of instruments really called to me, and be able to feel ready to drop some cash on my own gear. But I borrowed a lot, and I utilized friends' equipment and utilized my friends to teach me how to do things. And I've had a lot of support along the way. And now I'm making electronic music with a friend of mine. We have a project called Carbon Dating. It's all we call playing live. So we play, we're not DJing, we're actually producing our music live. We use a lot of various equipment from sequencers to synthesizers and pedals. And we do a lot of the programming ahead of time, kind of working through song sequences, but then everything is played live when we perform. And I'm also trying to work on my own music development, but it takes time. And that's one thing that I've always really struggled with. It's like right now, S1 needs a lot of my time and energy. And so that is a very easy thing for me to put my energy into. And it's hard for me to figure out how to develop my own personal practice and routine of sitting down in front of the equipment and making myself just turn everything on and start poking some buttons and making some noise and seeing where it takes me. If I'm working with a collaborator, then I feel like, oh, I have someone that's helping hold me accountable. And I'm like, well, I said we have rehearsal, so I have to show up regardless of how tired I am right now. But if it's just for me and I come home from work and I've been swinging a hammer and heavy tools all day, the idea of like standing and playing music is really hard to get me to do that. So it's a bit of a challenge, but S1 has definitely been a key component to where I'm at and my interest and ability to be making music right now.
So you graduated high school, and then you like went to community college, right? Mm-hmm. And then you went to another college.
Mm-hmm.
And then through that college you like went through all of that like volunteer work. Was that what it was?
After college?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, like, go to that? Like, how do you get to those things? Like, how do you, like...
Are you trying to ask, like, how she figured out who to volunteer for? Like, how she accessed those communities?
Or... Yeah. How did she, like, access them?
There's actually quite a few moments for me where when I've been very intentional about what I'm wanting and really wanting a thing to happen, somehow that thing comes into my life. I either notice it more, I stumble upon it, an opportunity comes up. And I literally was walking down the street going to breakfast with a friend, and it had been a street Belmont Street that I'd walked down before, and literally the day before there was no sign on this building, and the next day it said Portland Art Center, and I was like, wait, what is that? I didn't see that before. Like, what is that? And I went home and I'm like, I think Google was a thing then.
Oh, come on, it was.
I know. I mean, okay. yeah, I Googled it, and they had volunteer opportunities, and there was an application, and I was really nervous. I was like, oh my God, this place is so cool. Like, I've never done this before. Like, are they going to like me? And they really wouldn't have cared. I could have just walked in without filling out the application, but I totally filled out the application and I printed it out and I walked in and, you know, honestly, there was a very beautiful man who walked through the door and he was installing his show. And I was like, I got dressed up, you know, I was like I was applying for an interview. I was like, I'm really interested in volunteering. I brought this application. And John was like, you want to work right now? Mm-hmm. And I was like, I looked down. I was like, well, normally I'm not dressed like this. I was like, I'm not in my work clothes, but I'll come back. And so it was really, honestly, my willingness to just show up and do whatever it took and show up whenever they needed me to. And so that one specifically, it was like, I was really interested. I was looking. I had my eyes out for the thing I was looking for, and then did some research, you know, met with the people, and then just kept showing up. And the other ways were going to shows, talking to people at those venues, finding out how that venue works. It's a nonprofit. Is anybody paid? Who is running it right now? Like, can I talk to them? Usually people are pretty open to you talking to them, but it does take some initiative to show up. You got to go to the shows, go to the productions, go to the spoken word or poetry readings or theater productions and find out who the director is, talk to the actors, talk to the artists, and just ask them questions. People, I think you will be surprised at how open most people are. There are definitely a lot of people who have a lot of front that they put up and they're not interested in talking and like, so what? Like, go talk to them. And if they're not nice, like, don't talk to them again. Find somebody else to talk to. But it's really just about showing up, engaging in some way, asking questions and finding out how you can be involved. Usually people are super, even if it's a for-profit space and you want to volunteer, they want your help. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is the best way to get engaged, is unfortunately free labor, but it's also, you have a lot of opportunities to increase your skill sets that way, and then you meet more people.
Did you do gallery work in high school, and like, how would you give any advice to us?
The most experience I had was in the theater, and I had a lot of opportunities to be a lead role in productions, helping coordinate and set things up. So that was really like, any opportunity you have to be on the organizing side is really, really beneficial, and you will learn a lot. I'm sure you already are right now. And I think it really depends on the thing that you're trying to do. I could have a lot of advice about like how to curate shows or like how to install work. But I think being engaged with the artist, figuring out what it is that they're trying to communicate, and figuring out what the best way is to get their message through. And sometimes that means like they have an idea and they have a goal, but their means of executing it or their idea of execution isn't going to get them to the right place. So figuring out, you know, are they on the right track? Is their goal going to be best supported by whatever choices that they're making or the choices that you're making in terms of how the work is displayed or where it's presented? And I think also really questioning the status quo. If there is a certain way that you think things are supposed to be done, ask yourself why. Investigate, like, is that really important still? Is that important in this case? Is that the best way to do this? Or would it be better to challenge whatever way in which it's quote unquote supposed to be done? Like, that was a big thing for me in being a preparator and running galleries, was there is a way to install artwork. It should be, you know, 55 to 54 inches on center from the floor and installed in this sort of linear way, because that's the best way for the artwork to be received, and it's at like general eye height, and it's like museum standards, and the lighting should be such and such way. But for me, sometimes even if it's paintings, maybe that's not the best presentation. Maybe all the paintings should be clustered together right next to each other on one wall, and all the walls are empty, all the rest of them are empty. Or maybe they're all leaning on the floor. Maybe they're all hanging on the ceiling. Like, really, I think questioning, you know, sometimes that method is the best, because you're not trying to call attention to the installation. You really want the work itself to be seen and experienced. So I think just being aware of the ways in which you think things should be done, and if there's another way, and thinking outside of the box always, and questioning whatever box it is you think you're in or think you should be in, just question, because sometimes it's the right answer, but yeah. You don't know unless you ask the question.
Hmm. Yeah. Seems like good general advice for like
life,
artists, and life. Well, we're close to time. Did either of you have anything else you wanted to say, ask, or add?
No.
I just wanted to add that we at S1 are an all-volunteer run nonprofit, and there are opportunities for people to volunteer. We have been working on how we can engage youth more, and we've been trying to figure out how we can do all ages shows more often. If we want to sell alcohol, then we basically have to make it over 21, or it's really hard to also allow people under 21 to attend our events. So we're trying to do more all ages shows. We are open to volunteers who are not 21, and we're interested in doing more youth programming. So there are opportunities for anyone in this class to be engaged. You can come to our workshops. Our workshops are not 21 and over. I imagine anyone 16 or over could come, and if you were under 16, if you came with a parent, that would probably be just fine. And being a member of the Synth Library is $20 a month, and you get access to reserve time to have facilitated time in our library using all of the gear. And we have an incredible amount of gear that is currently underutilized. So if you're interested, we have a website, s1portland.com, and there's information on how to get involved.
All right.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
On Wings, Women Opening the Civil Society Consultation, March 10, 2019, around the UN Commission on the Status of Women.
Without universal health care, free public education, safe transport for women, sanitation, decent work, and basic income security over the life cycle, there cannot be gender equality.
The infrastructure that supports care is totally missing in most countries. Issues of childcare have always been seen as a little NGO must do this, underfunded, in a little corner all by themselves, with parents who have to have user fees, and in many cases, who cannot afford this.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
It was February 1947 when the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women first met and declared its aim, quote, to raise the status of women irrespective of nationality, race, language, or religion, to equality with men in all fields of human enterprise, and to eliminate all discrimination against women in the provisions of statutory law, in legal maxims or rules, or in interpretation of customary law. That takes a long time. The Commission still meets annually to evaluate progress, identify challenges, set global standards, and formulate policies. They accept input both from governments and non-governmental organizations, and the NGOs hold parallel events outside of UN headquarters, starting with a big consultation day organized by NGO CSW New York. The 2019 consultation kicked off with a drum corps from Brazil. Here's Paprika.
Que diferença da mulher o homem tem? Espera aí que vou dizer meu bem. Que o homem tem cabelo no peito, tem o queixo cabeludo e a mulher não tem.
What's the difference between a woman and a man? Listen up and we'll explain it best we can. Is that a man grows hair on his chest and his head goes bald? Not so much with a woman. What's the difference between a woman and a man?
Listen up and we'll explain it best we can.
Is that a woman can give birth to a baby and then feed it with her body and a man can.
No paraíso um dia de manhã, Adão comeu maçã. Eva também comeu. Então ficou a dança sem nada, Eva sem nada. Se Eva deu uma bocada, Eva também deu.
5,000 years ago there was a confusion. There was a fruit that cured a delusion. There was a story of a fall that changed it all. There was a writer who blamed the woman. But that's a lie, it wasn't her fault. The snakes are the man's. Nobody knows why he came to that conclusion.
No paraíso um dia de manhã, Eva comeu um céu, Eva também comeu. Então ficou a dança em nada, Eva sem nada. Se Eva dormiu uma cada, Eva também deu. Mulher tem duas cornas, duas braças, duas costas, uma nisso e uma boca e tem muita inteligência. O bicho, o homem, também tem o mesmo jeito, sem forrer para direito, tem um pico de diferença.
A woman has two legs, two arms, a big heart and a brain that works very nicely. A man also's got two legs, two arms, a big heart and a brain. There's not much difference.
Precisely.
There's not much difference between a woman and a man. We don't think that being nice is something only feminine, and we don't think taking charge, being assertive, making decisions, playing music, or being a Supreme Court judge is the only masculine thing.
Que diferença da mulher o homem tem? Que diferença da mulher o homem tem? Espera aí que vou dizer meu bem. Que o homem tem cabelo no peito, tem o queixo cabeludo e a mulher não tem.
There are women who never had a child. There are men who never go bald. There are all kinds of people engaged in all kinds of contact. That's why we think that gender is mostly a construct.
Que diferença da mulher o homem tem? Espera aí que vou dizer meu bem. Que o homem tem cabelo no peito, tem o queixo cabeludo e a mulher não tem.
I'd say loosely translated version. A variation, an
improvisation upon a novelty song.
An old Brazilian song that asks, what's the difference between a woman and a man? We think there's not much difference, but we're here to celebrate women.
Give it up for Paprika. Woo! So welcome everyone this morning. Thank you for coming out on this rainy day. This is our Civil Society Consultation Day, brought to you by the NGO Committee on the Status of Women New York. This is a committee which represents hundreds of member organizations and individuals from around the world who are working for the rights of women and girls. My name is Safira Rameshwar, and I am a representative of the Baha'i International Community to the United Nations and a secretary of the NGO Committee on the Status of Women New York.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Azi Khalili. I'm from the International Alliance of Women and a member of the NGO CSW Executive Committee. Safira and I will be your MCs this morning. Today, we aim to strengthen our relationships with one another, with UN women, with national governments of the world, and the many civil society organizations working towards women's liberation and gender equity. So let me welcome everyone here today. Welcome to all from Africa. To those from Asia and Middle East. To those of you from Europe, Latin America, North America, and Australia. Welcome to all indigenous peoples from around the world. Today is the opening day of the largest annual gathering of feminists. 9,000 women and male allies have come to New York City to participate in CSW 63. In the next 2 weeks, we will have over 400 parallel events and workshops, a reception, caucus meetings, artisan fairs, and opportunities to network.
It is my great pleasure to introduce to you the chair of the NGO Committee on the Status of Women New York, Dr. Susan O'Malley. For the past 8 years, Susan has been the chair and the former vice chair of NGO CSW New York. She is a tireless leader and is a woman who believes in the empowerment of others, and she has also been one of my personal mentors. Susan is a Shakespeare professor and plays the cello in the UN orchestra. So I'll now hand over to Susan, who will give a welcoming message.
If I was your mentor, I've done a really good job. What can I say? Safira, that was very nice, and Azzy too. Wow, the lights are strong. Welcome to the NGO CSW Forum and to the largest commission, I believe, the largest commission gathering in the history of the UN. As Azzy said, yes, over 9,000 people signed up to attend. This is on the UN Women website, although not all of them will be able to get to New York City because of visa denials. We've had more and more this week. And the expense of New York City. And welcome to New York City in March and our lovely weather. At least it's not snowing. And finally, welcome to the excitement in moving the global feminist movement forward by exchanging analyses and good practices in our 400 parallel events, organizing together in our 5 regional caucuses, honing our skills in our advocacy training sessions, and networking with each other to strengthen our work. Now, all of this is in the handbook, the absolutely beautiful handbook that you received when you came in. There's also an app, as you know, on our website. The priority theme for CSW 63, social protection systems, access to public services, and sustainable infrastructure, is essential. Without universal health care, free public education, safe transport for women, sanitation, decent work, and basic income security over the life cycle, there cannot be gender equality. According to UN Women, social protection is a set of minimum guarantees, including basic income security for children, working age adults, older people, and people with disabilities, as well as essential health care for all. The International Labor Organization definition of social protection floors holds promise for women who are overrepresented among those excluded from existing social protection systems. Women need to participate in decision-making about social protection policies. For social protection to be effective, they need to be provided by national governments and to be supportive of the idea of solidarity among the rich and poor, with redistribution occurring through taxation. But inequality is growing globally, and taxes on the wealthy are being cut, resulting in austerity and the cutting back of public services. A number of the parallel events for CSW 63 speak of the lack of social protection for women in their countries. I learned a lot from reading the applications of the parallel events, particularly from women in Africa, who talked to me about the effect of free trade, public-private partnerships that increase debt, and the lack of participation of women in decision-making on social protection policies. We can learn much from them as we discuss together how to move the agenda forward on social protection, which is also crucial in the ability of national governments to implement the Sustainable Development Goals. When you look at them, number one on poverty, two, zero hunger, three, good health, four, quality education, five, gender equality, six, clean water, eight, decent work, and nine, infrastructure. It's all in social protection. Now, if the Undersecretary General and Executive Director of UN Women, Pumzili, could come to the stage, and also the Bureau President, CSW Ambassador Geraldine Bernadette, and also our wonderful moderator, Shireen Tadros.
On Wings, you are listening to voices from the 2019 NGO-CSW Consultation Day, where delegates from non-governmental organizations learn what ideas are front and center for the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women, that they can discuss with their UN representatives and promote to their governments back home. You just heard Susan O'Malley, a member of the International Federation of Business and Professional Women and chair of the host organization. Next, you'll hear some remarks from the women she called to the stage. UN Women was created in 2010. Its executive director is recognized as an undersecretary general. The first executive director was former president of Chile, Michelle Bachelet. Since 2013, that post has been held by a former deputy president of South Africa, whose name is very controversial, specifically her husband's surname, which includes a click. Pronunciations found online vary wildly. Versions used by officials and reporters include Nuka, Nuka, and Kuka. Here is how Susan O'Malley dealt with it.
Pumzili, Malambo, and I'm getting practicing. I'm getting my click down. Maybe I'll get.
Wings editor Sarah Newton made a study and after practice achieved this.
Pumzili, Malambo, Nuka.
Wings series producer Frieda Worden, that's I, fell back on a politely anglicized version. Former deputy president of South Africa, Pumzili, Malambo, Nuka. The second speaker on the panel is Ireland's permanent ambassador to the UN, Geraldine Byrne-Nason. The moderator is Shireen Tadros. Tadros was formerly Al Jazeera's correspondent in Gaza. She now heads the New York United Nations Office of Amnesty International.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate the energy in this room. I think that this subject, when we're talking about social protection, women and girls, it's just so important. And in my 3 years at the UN, I have to say that probably, as we're amongst friends, I can be honest, that my biggest frustration has been that although we talk so much about access and inclusiveness, we then end up using language that is not very accessible. It's not very UN-like to be so excited on a Sunday morning and braving the rain, but I really appreciate all of you being here. And I'll start, if I could, with Undersecretary Pumzili and talk to you about UN women who have done so much about social protection, especially this year, but also in the past. Tell us a little bit more about how you define at UN Women social protection and why it's so important.
UN Women has been very concerned about the underrepresentation of issues that have to do with care, given that this is something that actually defines a lot of the challenges that women and girls face that determine their lives. We were excited when in SDG 5, the issue of care found itself to the final points that are made in Goal 5. Because for as long as I have been an activist, we have been struggling to locate this debate about unpaid care, to actually have it reflected in the Sustainable Development Goals, I think, was a big victory, thanks to many of you who have stayed the course. Because if you think about what oppresses the majority of women in the world, it is the fact that they are the ones that have the burden of care, and the infrastructure that supports care is totally missing in most countries, and social protection does not actually extend itself to the women in many parts of the world who needs it most. So to be in a position this year to bring together the issue of infrastructure that is sustainable and responsive to the needs of women, and policy dialogues that must provide women with the services they need within public sector has been pushing the frontiers and placing these issues also in the context of macroeconomics. Because again, issues of childcare have always been seen as a little NGO must do this, underfunded, in a little corner all by themselves, with parents who have to have user fees, and in many cases, who cannot afford this. So what we've done, I think, this year, is to take what to some people is an obscure issue and put it on the main, on the major stage. We are trying to say that whether it's caring for the aged, for the sick, for children, this is what defines society. The fact that it's taken us so long, even as the United Nations put this issue on the center stage in the way that we have, means that maybe we've just for a long time forgotten that there's children and old people that we live with. And suddenly we're like, these people exist. Their well-being impacts on all of us. And the one who's always paying the price is a six-year-old girl and a mother and a grandmother who shoulders this burden. And this is the way we would like you to also help us explain the topic and push for responsibility to be taken by member states to view this issue differently.
Thank you, and thank you for homing in on one very practical thing about childcare. And I want to turn to you, Ambassador, because Fumzi was just speaking about sustainable infrastructure, but that takes funds, that takes money, and we're living in a world where we're becoming increasingly economically challenged. We're seeing a rise of authoritarianism across the world, a decline in human rights, and those sort of values that would lead to states deciding that they should invest in those kind of projects. So, you know, what's the answer? How do we take this forward, this idea of social protection?
There isn't a single woman, global north or global south, who knows that the availability of what Fumzile has just described in terms of social supports for childcare, maternity benefit, free education, they are fundamental enablers for women to take their proper place in society. And in a difficult economic environment, governments recognize that they're actually losing out by having 50% of their talented, and increasingly as governments invest in free education, as many governments do for young women and girls, they're actually not realizing their investment. And I think that's an important issue, because money speaks to governments, that if you invest in a young woman's education, you deliver an ambition by way of prospect to her, and then because the follow-through policies aren't in place, whether it's a bus that can take her to school to finish her education, or whether it's indeed, as we know in many places, that's that toilet that allows a girl post-puberty to stay in school, the government is actually economically impeding itself. The second issue that I think in terms of infrastructure, but more generally, that's important, is that I like to think of social protection across the whole range of issues we look at as allowing us to fly, an enabler, but catching us if we fall. And that question of the safety net is really a way of leveling the playing field for women in the labour market. Again, in times of austerity, governments really need to look across how they can facilitate women who move off the labour market for short or longer periods to re-enter the market. I know that in the context of work that's being done in the African Union, in the OECD, that those gaps in women's participation in the labour market are becoming, the ILO, I'm sure we'll speak to this later today, becoming increasingly the focus. Why do we start off with as many female graduates as men and then find that within 3 or 4 years of career that these women are not anymore in the labour market? I can tell you, just as an anecdote as I conclude, from an Irish perspective, just until 1974, when Ireland joined the European Union, as a female professional, as a female in the public service, if you married, you had to resign. At that point, the marriage age was on average 24 years old. So back in 1973, I went to university in 1979, so this is not another world. Young women saw their careers ending without any prospect of re-entering that labour market at the age of 24. Now, admittedly, Ireland has come a long way very quickly, but it's an illustration of how policies that appear from the outside, or even countries that appear from the outside, not to understand the economics of their decisions, can come a long way quickly.
Thank you for that. Of course. Please.
I want to also highlight the fact that in many economies where women are able to have maternity leave, if they work, they lose on the benefits. At work, one benefit to be at home, but you lose on a benefit to be upwardly mobile in your workspace because you are regarded as a burden and a risk because you take time away. How dare you go and give birth to the next generation? We're going to take something from you. You are not going to get promotion. The man, when she has a baby, in some economies, you are actually rewarded. For every child, you have additional income. Your tax benefits are improved as well. So, as the ILO says, the woman gets a penalty and the man gets a reward. And the man is rewarded because he is a breadwinner, expectedly. It is assumed that every father looks after their child, and every mother, you must take them with suspicion. Really? If you go to the claims court for child benefits, there isn't a long queue of men who are looking for mothers who must support their children. It is the mothers who are the ones that are not getting the benefit. So social protection dialogue is about trying to even out all of these issues so that we can actually see how sometimes we give with one hand the maternity leave, but we take with another hand because of the way we treat women as employees.
I was going to say, so many people are you know, nodding in the audience, and I know you were one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Really important points that Fumzile makes there. And just two, she always inspires me, but she inspires me to say two things there. One of which is that maternity policies, child benefits, you know, we will discuss this in the CSW in the next couple of weeks. They're not a sort of a straight line entry of a policy that you introduce into a system and it solves the problem. While I was preparing for today, I looked into my own history and I saw that while the Irish government, probably quite progressively in 1944, introduced child benefit, it was only 30 years later that women were entitled to pick up that benefit themselves, because the benefit was introduced, but for the father to collect the benefit. So it took, again, I have to say, this magical entry of Ireland into the European Union to allow women themselves to pick up that benefit. And then I have to say, again, an evolving policy, because it was another 20 years and Mary Robinson, one of the greatest stalwarts of women and their evolution in Ireland, worked to ensure that unmarried women and that so-called deserted wives, or women who had been married and found themselves alone in a society where there was no divorce, were enabled to pick up those benefits. So my illustration is to say that the policy is one thing, the evolution and the application of the policy is critical, and I think that that's a point that Fumzile, and with the great aid of the ILO, that we will eventually get to those more utopian versions of what we're talking about.
Okay, given that, how do you think we should move forward in the next 2 weeks? What would you like to see out of CSW this year?
Well, I have to say, the first thing I'd like to see is to keep everyone in this room here doing what you do so brilliantly year round, because the role of civil society in the CSW is by far the greatest illustration in the whole UN system of how civil society impacts on government policy. I can't think of any other area, and as a government ambassador, I'm responsible for a whole range of policies. This is the one where you can make a difference. It's also one where, frankly, on the ground, in a domestic sense, governments are much more, I think, liable to listen to you. A big portion of every government's budget goes to social protection. It happens to be a big item of expenditure. I think the highest in the world, maybe France, other countries bring up the rear. On average, in the OECD countries, about 20% of a government's budget goes on social protection. So if there's a pressure from civil society on local governments, I mean local as in national governments, they're bound to listen. I saw it firsthand during a huge economic crisis in Ireland, and I was involved in supporting the government at the time. The efforts of civil society, and particularly what we call the grey economy, in protecting social welfare policies from ending up insulating them from the austerity measures was absolutely critical.
And I hope that you will take back home fond memories of this session, but also great energy and go back home and make things happen.
Voices from the Civil Society Consultation held March 10, 2019, in preparation for the annual session of the UN Commission on the Status of Women. Wings editor Sarah Newton.
The outcome of the two-week meeting: delegates adopted a list of key recommendations and agreed conclusions, which include building on multilateral commitments to gender equality, investing in social protection, and scaling up investment in quality public care services.
In 2020, the Commission will review the Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action, a plan unanimously adopted at the UN's Fourth World Conference on Women in 1995. Find more information at unwomen.org. Thanks to generous crowdfunding, Wings will be sharing our recordings from the 1995 conference. For information, email wings@wings.org. This program was produced by Sarah Newton and Frieda Worden. Thank you to your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, the International Association of Women in Radio and Television, USA Chapter, and Genevieve Vaughn.